Well, good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to welcome everyone here this evening and to welcome our speaker, Max Steuer. Max has just joined the LSE. Well, not really. Max joined the economics department at the LSE in 1959. He took over James Mead's lectures on international economics. Many of his publications were in that area, notably The Impact of Foreign Investment on the United Kingdom, written with a number of co-authors. His publications have been in a wide variety of fields, including macroeconomics, the theory of the firm, labor economics, and development economics. He wrote Mathematical Sociology with Janet Holland. Max has taught in 5 departments in the school, which may be a record, or so he claims. Under the impetus of the then convener of the economics department, Eli Devons, Max promoted the 1-year taught master's degree, which has replaced the master's degree by thesis throughout the school and indeed the rest of the country. I actually wrote a master's degree here and I had to do it by a thesis, and in those days the thesis had to be almost as long as a PhD, so I think taught master's might have been easier really. He invented the title Methods of Economic Investigation and taught that course for many years. Max has been a fundamental influence in the development of the Cities program at the LSE. He has an active interest in the physical environment of the school and has helped a great deal with the renovation of the campus, which is now firmly underway. Max has been an academic governor and dean of the graduate school. Apart from his academic interests, he wrote the film script for the feature film The Committee, directed by Peter Sykes. This is news to me, but he has held world records in hot air ballooning. But I did know the next bit, that he plays bass guitar in the Irving Street Band. This is the book which he will be discussing this evening, and I congratulate him on it. It is his 4th book. It is an extraordinary work because of its range and because of its incisiveness. Max covers topics in 5 social sciences: anthropology, economics, political science, and sociology. He looks at a range of substantive areas of investigation, including crime, migration, the family, money, housing, and religion. The point is to gain an understanding of what social science is and what it can contribute to social policy too. It is, I think, a remarkable achievement. And it is a book in the best traditions of the LSE. So please give Max Steuer a very warm welcome.
Thank you very much, Tony, for those kind remarks. Very nice of you, and much appreciated. And it is much to your credit that you promoted a debate in the school on the nature and function of social science. My particular niche in that debate has to do with the actual practice of social science. I've tried to marshal, as you've described, the actual research which social scientists undertake. One of my motives in doing this is that when I listen in on some of the debates that go on regarding social science, I can hardly recognize that field in those debates. I think it's important to see what social scientists actually do when they undertake research. I have other motives. One is that I think we're a little overly specialized, and I think it's important and helpful for social scientists to find out what people in other disciplines are doing. And I guess my third motive is that I'm worried when activities which I think are unscientific take on the mantle of social science, when in fact they're doing something which in my view has very little to do with science in any form. So I'd like to start by being a bit autobiographical, if I might, a bit reminiscing. When I was a lad, I knew, or at least I was pretty sure, that I was going to go to university. I was pretty confident that that was something that I would do. What I didn't know was what I would do when I got there. And I must confess I was a bit envious of the young men and women who knew that they were going to be doctors or lawyers and were going to go to university to acquire the training and the qualifications that they would need to pursue their careers. All that I knew was that I wasn't going to be a doctor or a lawyer. And then I had a stroke of really good luck. There was an ad, an advertisement in Life magazine that said that if you sent in $2, you could get a book that would tell you why there were business cycles, why there was poverty in the midst of plenty, or what caused wars, and several other things. And I certainly knew when I saw that list that that was a book that I wanted to read, and those were things that I wanted to find out about. And the summer before I went to university, I received that book, I read it. I think you might say I devoured that book. It's not a great masterpiece, I suppose, in economics. It was Henry George's Progress and Poverty was the book. But it wasn't a bad way to start. It was analytical. It had a clear thesis. It was addressed to human problems and proposed a way of making life better. It had evidence, an appeal to evidence, and it was related to the structure of economic knowledge. It referred carefully to the classics, Adam Smith, David Ricardo, John Stuart Mill, Alfred Marshall. And so when I got to university, it was quite clear to me that I was going to do economics. And I'm living my life in economics, and I have absolutely no regrets about that. However, as much as I enjoyed that book, I did feel in the end that perhaps it promised a little more than it actually delivered, and that there were problems in the argument, and there was need for better analysis, better use of logic in exploring the nature of economies. It seemed to be quite clear that there was more work to be done. And one of the real pleasures I've had in being involved in economics over these many years is the way the subject evolves and improves, and I think it's almost unrecognizable, even over a relatively short period, how much improvement there's been in the subject. So with this orientation, you can imagine that it's a source of some disappointment to me, agitation, to put it mildly, some source of concern when I hear people say, as they sometimes do at the extreme, that science doesn't really exist, that all opinions, one opinion is as good as another, that social science is a kind of sham and an impossibility. I find that extremely upsetting because I'm convinced, and I hope that my book is a help in making the case, that social science has an enormous amount to contribute to human well-being. But even more than that, I get upset when I see things going on that claim to be social science, but in my view have nothing to do with science in any form. So let me outline what I think about how I think about science as an activity, and then I'll try to contrast that a bit with activities which I think are pretend social science. the basic point which I really want to emphasize above others is that, in my view, there's no sharp distinction, in fact, no distinction at all, between natural and social science. I see the two as pursuing the same goal, the goal of understanding, and I think the methods are essentially the same. Perhaps a little later on in this lecture, I'll say something about the differences between natural and social science. I think there are differences of emphasis, of differences of degree, but fundamentally, I think they're very much the same, and I hope to make that case. So science is a human activity. It's engaged in by individuals who work on a tiny little corner of that great structure of ideas and theories, categories, observations, which make up science. Nobody understands the whole of it. There's nobody in charge of it. There's nobody who works on anything other than a tiny little corner. People do their work. They go away. Other people come along. And that structure grows and develops and improves. And it's interesting to think about the kind of work that scientists undertake when they're engaged in that activity. One of the things they do is look for and try to remove redundancies. The structure of scientific ideas, the structure of material which makes up science, is not totally neat and orderly. It contains various duplicates, various redundancies. And one of the things that scientists do, one of the kinds of work that they undertake, is to remove redundancies. At the London School of Economics, Dick Lipsey and Kevin Lancaster wrote a famous paper called The General Theory of the Second Best. This paper, among other things, pointed out that four or so ideas in economics, which people thought were distinct ideas, were in fact the same idea, and therefore this article, among other things, was successful in removing some redundancies. There are other kinds of work that scientists, many kinds of work that scientists undertake, but the key thing which I want to emphasize is that what scientists do is they work on that structure of ideas and theories and evidence and observations and so on, which make up the body of science. Another type of work they do is to attempt to resolve or remove inconsistencies. The structure of science is by no means totally coherent. Nancy Cartwright, one of our professors of philosophy, describes science as being higgledy-piggledy. And I think that that's quite a reasonable description, and there are good reasons why it's like that. When new ideas come along, they may have implications which are inconsistent with other ideas in science. The other ideas may also have value, but there are areas of inconsistency. And so we don't wait in science to have totally coherent structure. The body of science improves and develops, and it contains inconsistencies. And we don't like it. We don't enjoy, we don't welcome these inconsistencies and contradictions, but sometimes we have to live with them, and sometimes we have to live with them for quite a long time. But one of the tasks that scientists undertake is to remove inconsistencies and try to find ways of making the structure of scientific ideas more logical, more coherent. There are efforts of precision. People try to make science more precise. Very often, scientific ideas start out very loosely, and then they get refined and developed. Perhaps a mathematical formulation emerges. There's greater precision. And also, people tend to occasionally have come up with new ideas, and so the structure of science develops. A little corner is added here, a little bit is added there, and the structure improves, and so on. But let me repeat that the key thing is that the people who do science work on that structure in one way or another. I've tried to characterize some of the kinds of work that they do when they do science, be it natural science or social science. The interesting and distinguishing features, in my view, of pretend social science is that those activities, which come in a variety of forms, which I'll try to describe, are separate from this structure. They are not concerned with this body of interconnected theories, observations, ideas. They're off on their own. Professor Karl Popper, distinguished philosopher at the London School of Economics, used the phrase social profits. people who stand alone from the body of science and come out with statements about what the world is like or what's going to happen or what's going on. And the thing about those statements is that they have nothing to do with the structure of science. They're not derived in any way. They're just standalone propositions. A few months ago, I was having dinner with some members of the London School of Economics Financial Markets Group. At that time, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was in the 9,000s. And perhaps having had a drink or two too many, I pronounced over dinner that we would see the Dow Jones average in the 7,000s before we saw it in the 11,000s. And unfortunately, that prediction turned out to be correct. But the point is, it had nothing to do with science in any form. It was simply off the cuff of what Popper calls social prophecy, and that's not science. Nowadays, there's more of what I call social poetry going on rather than social prophecy. The social poet has a goal which is rather different from the social scientist. The social poet tries to create a mood, a certain atmosphere in the listener, which has a lot to do with giving the listener, giving you, giving me, the feeling that this is the way the world is, this is what's going on, this is what you're like, this is what I'm like. The social poet creates a kind of stew pot, and various elements are put in. Names occur, Foucault, Marx, Habermas, Freud go in the pot. Ideas, observations go in the pot. There are lots of computers around in the world today. The world population is bigger than it used to be. The pot is stirred. Other elements are put in. The money is flowing around the world more rapidly than in the past. There's a lot of terrorism and so on. And none of this relates, it's not a test of a theory, it doesn't do any of the kind of scientific work which I described, and it's not intended to. It's intended to create a certain state of mind in the listener, and when it's done well, social poetry is extremely effective. You can mesmerize an audience. It's not easy to do, and when it's done well, it has quite an impact, but it's not social science. A few weeks ago, I was having dinner with a postmodernist geographer, and he explained to me that everything is space. Everything is space. At the time, I was reading a book about why study media. It seemed a strange question to ask the book, because there are two reasons for studying anything. And they're the same for everything. One is it's inherently interesting, and another reason is it may be of some practical value. So I was a bit surprised when this book gave neither of these reasons for studying media. The reason for studying media was that everything is media. So I was a bit disturbed here. I'd just been told everything is space. Now I'm being told everything is media. Years ago, people used to have a complaint called the Napoleon complex. People thought that they were Napoleon. We don't see much of that around anymore. Nowadays, we see people who think that they're social scientists. But forgive me for that unkind remark. One way that therapists would treat people with Napoleon complexes, they put the two of them together, two people with that illusion, and let them argue it out, and maybe one would persuade the other that they weren't Napoleon. So my idea was to put the author who thinks everything is space in the same place as the author who thinks that everything is media. And my worst nightmare is that they will emerge from this debate and say, you know what? Everything is space, and it's media, and it's globalized, and it's very risky. And why that's a nightmare to me is because these ideas may be very suggestive, they may be very interesting, they may be very powerful, but they have nothing to do with science. Now, just before I turn to the second half of my lecture, I would like to say that not for one moment do I think that science is the only way of apprehending society or understanding society. Anybody who saw Jerry Robbins' wonderful ballet, The Age of Anxiety, or Balanchine's ballet, Ives the Honor, and particularly the last movement, The Unanswered Question, or, for example, any of the works of Beja, whose ballet was on a couple of weeks ago at the Peacock Theater just across the road. Anybody who is exposed to these things can see that art is not just entertainment. Great art is informative about society. But it's informative in a very different way from science. If you read a novel about the Great Depression, say The Grapes of Wrath or something, you can get a feeling of what it's like to be an unemployed urban worker or to be a farmer who's forced to sell his farm. You get a feeling of what it's like to be there. But that's a very different thing from an explanation of why there's a Great Depression or how to stabilize the economy. That is something which art is not very good at doing. So I'm now going to turn to a little glimpse of the content of my book and the kinds of things that go on there. I hope I won't disappoint you in saying that I hope you didn't come here as a substitute for reading my book. I hope that you would recognize that that's not really possible. There are hundreds and hundreds of articles in there, and I do hope that you read the book. But I would like to give just a little glimpse of the sorts of things that go on there, starting perhaps with anthropology. Anthropology is the most specific of the social sciences. If you read articles in anthropology, they direct you to a particular group of people. They tell you the names of these people. They tell you where they live. They quote the language. They may give you a few words in the language and so on. Very specific, very sensitive, very empathetic observation. Anthropology is a very difficult thing to do, very subjective, and a very important wing of social science investigation. It can be directed to remote areas, or it can be directed to much less remote areas. One of my favorite pieces of anthropology is a study of the experimental workers in small particle physics. There are about 1,000 of them. They operate in 4 or 5 centers. They know each other. They're like a tribe. They have their hierarchies. They relate to each other in various ways. They have their customs and so on. And an anthropologist can and has studied that tribe of experimental physicists, and it's a very interesting thing to do. There are problems with the discipline. Anthropologists very rarely visit the same site. It's a discipline which is less guided by theory than the other four social sciences, and it's also very subjective, and they very rarely check up on each other. If you take the literature of the past decade, the English language journal literature and anthropology, in the topics that I've investigated, there are only 2 cases where anthropologists have visited the same place. And when they do so, the results are a bit disturbing. I'll give you an example. An anthropologist went to a remote part of the Philippines to study a particular form of self-help activity that goes on there. Has slightly vigilante cast to it, this activity. The local people can't be protected from crime by the central government, so they form together in these groups, and they do other collective activity, and the anthropologist reports that this custom has deep roots in the culture of the Philippines. And so happened that another anthropologist went there, and he said, total nonsense. These groups were set up by the CIA to fight communism. They have nothing to do with the deep traditions of the Philippines, and as far as protecting people from crime, they're a major perpetrator of crime. They have murder and various other things. Who is right? As a cynic, I'm inclined to believe the latter. However, that's not science, and I think it is important that these differences of view, which can be very dramatic and can come out of a discipline which is very much reliant on subjective impressions without much theory to guide it, there is a problem with that. But it is nevertheless a very important wing of investigation in the social sciences. Political science is an interesting activity. It has two distinct branches to it, which I'm going to describe. It's a kind of puzzling thing. We're here this evening at the London School of Economics and Political Science. And we indeed have an economics department here, but no department of political science. We have what we call the government department. Ralph Dahrendorf, in his History of the London School of Economics, gives an explanation of why this change took place and why the name was changed. And his explanation has to do with the tendency, this is his view, that in Europe, the study of politics and power and so on is far more closely related to political philosophy than in the United States. And so that's why the term political science sits a little less readily in this area. I don't know whether he's right or not about that. I kind of suspect that in future decades, the distinction will matter a good deal less. However, political science has two wings to it, two strands. And if you look at the English language journal literature over the past decade, you will see that roughly half the articles are what I call macro anthropology. The political scientist uses techniques very similar to the anthropologist, the business of empathetic observation, careful immersion, very sensitive subjective observation. A good example would be a paper that I particularly like exploring the Maastricht Treaty, and particularly those aspects of the Maastricht Treaty which have to do with the common currency. The mystery for political scientists was, why was it that the leaders were so keen on monetary union when very few of the citizens of the member countries seemed to be enthusiastic about it? And the explanation which the researcher gives is that it had to do with the balance of power between Germany and France. And a very interesting theoretical and empirical case is built up for this based on lots of observations of public and private information. There are rival theories in political science about that. Some take a political economy view that the drive for monetary union had more to do with efficiency within the European countries and an improved competitive position with respect to the rest of the world. But that's a classic example, and there are lots of them, of that branch of political science. The other half of political science has to do with statistical investigation. An example that springs to mind has to do with the use of the death penalty in the United States. Some states in America use the death penalty a great deal. They have lots of people on death row, and they execute very young people, to my mind, frighteningly young people. Some states don't have the death penalty at all. Others have it on their books and use it a little bit, but not much. So what accounts for these differences? Well, the political scientist employs regression analysis. An index is constructed of these variations in the use of the death penalty, and a number of factors are brought to bear to explain how they come about. Things like whether the state is liberal or conservative, as measured in its voting behavior in presidential elections and in other ways. whether the state, the degree of urbanization within the state, the ethnic composition of the state, income inequality, and so on. These factors are used in statistical analysis to explain variations in the use of the death penalty. And there are, as I say, about half of the political science literature is of that kind. An economist is inclined to say that this is a bit of a fishing expedition. There's no clear theory here. There's kind of plausible intuition which is guiding the analysis. But nevertheless, it's interesting to see what is associated with what in explaining political and gaining more understanding of political phenomena. So those are the two branches. I'm now going to turn to the third social science discipline, social psychology. But before doing so, I'd just like to say a word or two about the difference between social science and natural science. There are about three or four differences, mainly of emphasis, of degree, and so on. Social science is less experimental than natural science. There is a good deal of experimental work in social science. Ken Binmore's group at UCL, this year's Nobel Prize was given in part for experimental work in social science. But nevertheless, on balance, there's less scope for experimenting in social science than in natural science. In my view, the most important difference between natural and social science has to do with the fact that social science subject matter is less uniform across time and across space. And I'll return to that in my concluding comments. If somebody discovers something about the electron, my view, or of course our view of the electron or any of the stars or whatever physical phenomena is changing, but the phenomena that we're studying is not changing in my view. And if something is discovered about carbon in Japan, that will probably be true of carbon in the United Kingdom and so on. But when it comes to social science matters, I think that's much less the case. There are other differences. Our friend George Soros places a lot of emphasis on reflexivity. You study something, you affect what you study. I think it's possible to make too much of that. There are scientific means of dealing with reflexivity. And I wonder if I could give some examples of I'll hold my examples perhaps until question time if we have them. But I think that the issue of reflexivity can be overplayed. So can the issue of values. It is true that in social science we are closer to value judgments than in natural science. But again, I think that can be overplayed. Now, coming back to social psychology, there is a big exception. If you look at the journal literature of the past decade, virtually 100% of the social psychology literature is about experiments. There is a, I'll give you a couple of examples. There's a social psychological theory which, among other things, predicts that if a beggar asks people for unusual amounts of money, he is more likely to be successful than if he asks for a conventional amount of money. There are various theories as to why that's so. And in order to test that theory, in order to do an experiment, the social psychologists dressed up as beggars and had an observer, and they approached people and they said, would you give me 17 cents, or would you give me 10 cents, or a quarter, and so on. And they chose the amount so that they could control for the issue of whether the beggar was asking for large amounts of money or small amounts of money. And indeed, it turned out that if you ask for unusual amounts of money, I suppose one should bear that in mind when appealing for higher salaries at the school, if one asks for unusual amounts of money, one is more likely to be successful than if you ask for a conventional amount. And indeed, the experiment confirmed the social psychological theory. When they were over, when they finished the experiment, of course, they had to do something with the money they had collected from innocent participants, and they gave that to an AIDS charity. Another example to do with crime, which I find very interesting, the different social sciences all specialize in the study of different kinds of crime. Social psychologists look mainly at rape. Sociologists are far more concerned with homicide. Economists tend to look at tax evasion and crimes committed by the government, and so on. But a typical social psychological experiment involves getting a large group of people who are deemed to be homogeneous and giving them certain information, and then varying the information in order to determine how information affects opinions and how opinions might influence action. So in this particular experiment, a large group of people, like people gathered here, are told the following story. A young man went into a student bar, and he struck up an acquaintance with a woman there, and they chatted for a while, and then he suggested to her that they go out to his car and smoke a marijuana cigarette. And they went out to his car and they smoked a cigarette, and then some kissing took place, and then some caressing and fondling took place, and then some undressing took place. All of this is agreed by both parties. And then the stories vary. The man claims that consensual sex took place at that point, and the woman claims that she was raped. So now the social psychologists divide the sample of people into four groups, and the first is told that the man was white and the woman was white, and the second is told that the man was black and the woman was black, and the third was told that the man was white and the woman was black, and the fourth is told that the man was black and the woman was white. And then they're asked to give their views. A very clever set of questionnaires are provided as to how likely they think it is that a rape took place. And one of the interesting results of this study is that the racial composition of the participants had no effect on whether people thought that it was likely that a rape took place or didn't. However, they were also asked a second set of questions as to how serious they regarded this matter, how much of a penalty would be suitable in terms of, say, years in prison for the man. And there, the racial composition made a big difference as to how serious people thought that the crime was. The white, and black case group reported significantly higher prison sentences, and this fits in also related to social psychological theory. And so the method, which I've tried to give a couple of examples, is very, very dependent on experimentation. Turning quickly to economics, it won't surprise the economists here this evening to know that about two-thirds of the papers in the English language journal literature of the past decade are pure theory exercises. Not necessarily directed to what we normally think of as economic phenomena. For example, there's an interesting paper about shelters. The non-economics literature, these are shelters for battered wives. The non-economics literature thinks that shelters don't work very well. And the reason that they give is that not many women go there, and the women who do stay a short amount of time and then tend to return to their husbands. And the economists build a model, typical sort of economics type model. The men get utility from the marriage, and they get utility from beating their wives. The women get utility from the marriage, and they get disutility from being beaten by their husbands. And there's asymmetry of knowledge in the model. The wives know how close they are to the wire of quitting, but the husbands don't know, and there are other features that you find in a standard economic model. And it turns out that over a reasonable wide range of circumstances, the existence of the shelter actually raises welfare for women, battered wives, even if they don't use it. It improves their bargaining position and so on. And it also shows the theory that for a certain class of circumstances, the existence of the shelter makes life worse for the women. And it's a kind of interesting and unexpected wrinkle, and it rather suggests that there might be certain policies that could be adopted that would take account of that. So, as I say, about two-thirds pure theory and about one-third empirical. I'll give you a quick empirical example. I haven't brought the figures with me, but it's absolutely amazing how many young men in the United States get arrested. In California and Philadelphia, there's just a huge proportion of young men get arrested. And the penalty, the apparent cost of getting arrested in terms of income is something on the order of about 16%. So you risk getting arrested, you lose about 16%. And this is a puzzle to economists, because the economists tend to think of people as being rational actors and so on. So a particular economist investigated using a very simple proposition, but also excellent empirical work and very good luck. His idea, the simple idea, was that maybe the people who get arrested don't have the same earnings potential as those who don't get arrested. And in California, the employment agency retains data on who, on people's salary and so on, for one quarter, but they were subject to litigation and had to retain that data for 5 years. So this gave an excellent opportunity to investigate by taking the Justice Department data, seeing who was arrested and so on, and comparing that to the employment data. One was able to get a reasonable run of figures, and it turned out that the people who were arrested, far from losing 16% of income, lost about 1%. And even that faded away in a relatively short amount of time. So I think that's a kind of interesting and insightful piece of empirical work. And as I say, about a third of economics is work of that kind and related. The fifth discipline, sociology, I have to say something about. The founders of sociology, the founding fathers, hoped to build a grand theory, an overriding theory, that would account for economic life and political life, social life, family life, and so on, would all be take their place under this grand theory. If one looks at the literature in the sociology journals in the past decade and the topics that I've explored, one sees no evidence of this grand theory at all. One sees instead masses of very interesting and sometimes powerful and very insightful work, but nothing to do with this grand theory. Steven Pinker, the linguist, brilliant lecturer and writer, in his book, The Language Instinct, takes the Mickey out of sociology and indeed social science, puts down social science enormously, and he never misses an opportunity at any lecture or anything he writes to put down and make fun of social science. I asked him once why he never mentions economics, and he didn't really have an answer to that question. But there are parts of his book, for example, where I think economics would help in, for example, precision in language for the listener and the receiver could be analyzed in a cost-benefit way, and there are also insights from sociology and anthropology about subgroups and secret languages and things of that kind, which I think would help his book. But nevertheless, it is the case that Pinker ferrets out gobbledygook sociology and seems to revel in it. And in all fairness, we have to admit, I think, that there's a fair bit of it about. However, that shouldn't worry us or shouldn't concern us. There's also masses of brilliant work in sociology, and I think my book provides dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of examples. I'll just give you one. A French study of 50 years of data on homicides within families, husbands killing wives and wives killing husbands. And this is related to the ease or difficulty of getting a divorce. It emerges that when it's harder to get divorce, you get more murders within the family, husbands killing wives, wives killing husbands. When it's easier to get a divorce, you get fewer of those murders. That's kind of intuitive. If the only way out of a marriage is murder, well, then that's one way out. However, what the article also gives us, which intuition can't give us, is how many more murders do you get when you make it harder to have divorce. And there's an interesting wrinkle in the tale, an interesting sting in the tale, you might put it. When in periods when it's easier to get a divorce, when there are fewer murders of husbands killing wives and vice versa, you get a slight rise in murders outside the family. It's sort of as if there are some people who are going to commit murder, or very probably, and if they're locked into a marriage that they can't get out of, the logical person to be the victim is their marital partner. But if they can get out, they'll murder perhaps somebody else. Well, I'm going to make my concluding remarks now. There are 4 points that I'd like to emphasize that I think follow from a reading of my book. And I very much hope that you will read the book. And I hope that these 4 points seem reasonable to you. The first has to do with the point I made about pure theory. It's a very interesting fact that if you look at the journal literature of the past decade, you will not find a single example of pure theory in any of the non-economics social sciences. And I think that that's a real problem. And it's a problem for all sorts of reasons. I'm very opposed to the idea which some people favor of an economics takeover. There are lots of reasons why I'm opposed. One has to do with the fact that as social scientists, we have a great advantage. We live in the laboratory, and different social scientists attend to different things. Every year, I tend to read a book about Einstein in the hopes that maybe I'll eventually understand what it's all about. I must confess that this is not the year. However, one of the things that interests me when I read about Einstein is he says things like, if I were inside an atom, I would do so and so, or if I was at the front of a beam of light traveling through space, I would observe this and that. In other words, he does these thought experiments, which may be useful, but in social science, we're right in the laboratory, and we can observe things all the time, and we attend to different things. Economists look at certain things, and sociologists attend to other things, and I think an economics takeover would very much diminish the subject. But unless the other subjects develop a taste and a technique for pure theory analysis, there is a real problem there with economists doing that kind of work in other disciplines not. Another conclusion that I would like to draw has to do with the contribution of the United States to social science. It is absolutely extraordinary what proportion of social science activity is United States research. It's no exaggeration to say, if you take a topic like migration, 80, maybe 90% of the articles, the research work on migration in the literature of the social sciences is about Mexican migration into the United States. Now, that work is interesting and so on, but we have enormous issues of migration in Europe and in the rest of the country, the rest of the world, and it, as I said in early parts of the lecture, there's no real carryover. We can't be sure of the carryover in social science, the same as natural science. So it's terribly important that we have much, much more social science investigation outside of the United States. The American work may be very valuable, but it's vital that more work be undertaken outside the United States. The third point has to do, you will have noticed that I haven't mentioned the subject matter-based activities. The subject matter-based activities are subjects like industrial relations, international relations, media studies, and so on. These subjects draw on the social sciences. They draw on economics and politics and sociology, and they draw on history and philosophy, and they're perfectly valid subjects. They're very, very important subjects. I have no problem with that, but I do think that unless the subjects, the disciplines that are there for them to draw on, we're in a very serious situation. Well, I said at the beginning of this lecture that I've had a life in economics, and I have no regrets about that. I also have had a life at the London School of Economics, and I have no regrets about that either. However, when I go about my travels and I see a van saying world-class institution, my stomach gets a bit, how shall I put it, and there are a couple of reasons for that. I think Shirley Williams was right when she said recently that there are no UK universities that are strong across the board. There may be good departments here and there, but as long as we fund universities in the chaotic and absolutely abysmal way that we do at the present time, I don't think there's any serious prospect of strength right across the board. That's not the only reason why I get a little upset when I see this world-class stuff. The other reason is that I would prefer it if other people said how good we are rather than for us to say how good we are. And if people are to say how good we are and it is to mean something, it has to be that we have strength in all of the five social science disciplines. I'm aware of the funding problems nowadays. We live in the age of funders and funding. And if you go to a potential funder and say, look, we have a wonderful government department. If you give us £1 million, we can make it a bit better. That's a difficult one to sell. But if you go and say, look, nobody's thought about crowds or risk or globalization or whatever, it may not be entirely true, but if you go to a funder and say, we're going to make a big push in these areas, that does sound more interesting. Well, I think that the future of the London School of Economics will depend in large part on being able to resist these swings and pushes that come from the funders and to maintain strength. If you look in my book, I think you'll see lots of evidence that the five social science disciplines are alive, very strong, have a great deal to say. And I very much hope that the London School of Economics will make the running in all of these in the decades to come. I can only thank you for your attention and coming to the lecture. Thank you.
We've got about half an hour for discussion as a roving mic going around the room. I must say it's good to hear someone making the case for social sciences as sciences, because you might remember that Margaret Thatcher at one point tried to redefine the social science as social studies, and the ESRC even picked that up in their classifications. Fortunately, they have now dropped it. I spend a lot of my life trying to persuade the government that when they give big money to science, that they have to include the social sciences too, and so far that has been successful. Anyway, I open the floor for questions, comments, observations. Do you want to take the mic though, because everyone can hear you at the top then?
I wanted to challenge your distinction between scientific study of society and non-scientific study of society, because you said that scientific study of society is similar to the natural sciences, and on the other hand you said that both of them are aimed at understanding what is happening. And if we'll take different examples like anthropology and neoclassical economics, I would say that I would say that in anthropology understanding is more available, or it is more possible for people to understand process using anthropological methods. But it is quite far from natural technology of producing knowledge. On the other hand, if we look at neoclassical economics, we will see a lot of differences, mathematics, models, everything. But don't you think that neoclassical economics is closer to social poetry, but just which is quite convincing, which has been turned to be very convincing for a couple of centuries for people, because understanding there, we lack sometimes understanding based on these econometric models.
Well, I'm afraid I won't surprise you by saying that I don't agree with that. Economics, of course, has its pure theory part of it. I never know quite what people mean when they say neoclassical economics. I'm never sure when that begins and ends, or what is it, the kind of economics that I do. But anyhow, I know what you're talking about. Models and so on, mathematics, etc., is less has less narrative quality than anthropology, and doesn't give you a feeling of dramatic, poetic presentation. But economics is far more than just the models. I mean, there's the empirical work and the relationship to society. We had a lecture a couple of weeks ago from Charlie Bean about the contributions of the London School of Economics to macroeconomic policy and so on. And I think that the role of economics in stabilizing economies and improving the well-being of millions of people is just overwhelmingly demonstrated. That's not to say that I agree with you that anthropology is a wonderful subject, wonderful activity, but its goals are not to simply provide an interesting tale about the Philippines or some other parts of the world. The goal is to improve our understanding of human society and how it functions, and it entails certain particular methods for so doing. I think it will be greatly improved if there's much stronger theoretical wing, and there's no reason why there can't be models in anthropology, and indeed there are glimmers of it in the study of kinship relationships, for example, where you get formal analysis and so on. But I think we will have much more of that, and I think that will be of benefit to the subject. So none of these categories, by the way, anybody would maintain are absolutely airtight or anything like that. We're talking about very fuzzy borders. There are centers of gravity between the subjects, but they blend and blur at the borders, and there's no sharp division. I hope you'd accept that.
So just like the mayors around the world are observing, are watching the city center, how the traffic flows, Professor Max, we all have listened to your lecture with maximal interest. I'm a little bit obsessed with your opening statement about poverty and misproperty, prosperity, sorry. Yeah. See, as you rightly said, as a social scientist, as a world, if you assume world as a global village, that Africa, you'd be all is a sky in our conscience. But that is a very big issue. We may not be able to address it. So there are pundits in this institute that who wanted to divide this world for their convenience, a civilized world and uncivilized world. We are the civilized part of the world. And here, we got the inner cities. I mean, compared to Africa for the whole, inner cities, they are separating mass or serpiginous ulcer. There, everything is there. I mean, plenty of religion, plenty of migration, plenty of crime. But there is very little family, very little housing, and no money at all. Why is that? That institution like this, why is that, that even the great leaders are not willing to address this problem? So may I suggest here that, like the Department of International Development, that we need, and maybe LSE will support this formation of Department of Intercity Development so that this issue will be addressed. Your treasury will benefit, we all will benefit.
Nice, thanks.
Thanks, Director, for your complimentary invitation.
The
Intercity
Development
I interpret your observation as suggesting that there are huge areas which are to some extent left unexplored. And I absolutely feel that. I feel that the need for far more coverage. Now, of course, in the developed world, we do tend to have economics of less developed countries. I was very upset when I arrived as professor of economics at the University of Ghana, where I spent 3 years, where they also had economics, and then there was a course called development economics. That seemed crazy to me. Every course in Ghana, in the economics department, should be about Ghana. If you wanted to have a little course on the income of economics of high-income countries thrown in for contrast or difference, that would be fine. But the idea that they copied the model absolutely entirely, so one of the things that I tried to do when I was there was get rid of the notion of development economics as such and have all of the economics, or the vast bulk of it, related to the issues that were important in the economy of Ghana. I don't know if I had all that much success. Many of my students, in fact, virtually all, were able to get very good jobs in Canada and in the United States and in the World Bank, and so I definitely succeeded in promoting economics, but not too many in Ghana, alas.
I was one of your students in 1969, and I'd just like to pay a testimony to your brilliant efforts at making an utterly dismal science interesting and entertaining. And I remember we were all shocked at your sort of, what should we call it, right-wing laissez-faire market analysis, free market proofs that pot should be legalised and there should be no immigration control. So we're devastatingly interesting to us all. So I just want to say, throughout the years, one thing you've done is make economics very interesting. To a serious question, I want to disagree with you about your characterization of both natural and social science in terms of promoting understanding. I'm persuaded to move away from that to a characterization in terms of giving us novel information or novel facts. The problem with the understanding issue is normally called the hermeneutic analysis of science, as the anti-positivists say, is that we don't get understanding in natural science. It's unintelligible to us. Newton found his own theory unintelligible, and understanding is very much a subjective concept. One person finds an understandable explanation in terms of whether it's gravitational mechanisms or actual distance or whatever, another person finds completely unintelligible. So the problem with the understanding approach is one man's understanding, one woman's understanding is another person's mystification. What I'd like to go more towards is the kind of philosophy that Imre Lakatos espoused, that we look at the prediction of novel facts or gaining novel information, because that isn't so subjective. And I'd just like to see what your objections to that would be, if that's okay.
I think that this is a very reasonable point. To throw the word understanding into the ring is a bit of a cheap shot. What I think is absolutely crucial about science, and I think that that also goes along with Emery's point about novel knowledge, what novel knowledge is still a part and linked to and comes out of the interconnected body of activity of so many kinds. I mean, there's theoretical entailment, there's observation, and so on. But the big thing about science, in contrast to other activities, is that it's a completely interlinked, interconnected activity. And one of the appeals of pretend social science, to me, my observation, is that it's a bit easier. To do science, you have to trace through complex links of interconnected reasoning and relate those to evidence and so on. Whereas if one is working away from science, one doesn't have to deal with that interconnected complex body. And what Emery was talking about with those novel observations and so on was they emerged from complex interactions of that existing body of theory. Would you agree with that? Thank you. I distinguish social science from astrology when it comes to the links to evidence, for one thing, in two ways. One is there's no mechanism that tells you why it is where the stars are is going to, at the point of birth, should influence your life. No mechanism is specified, so that it doesn't have that linked characteristic. But even beyond that, it doesn't pass any empirical test. So that's how I would distinguish astrology from astronomy.
Yeah, Tony Giddens tells us that you take an interest in the development of the physical environment of the school. Have you any idea then when they're going to stop pissing around with their bricks and that? They seem to have been doing that for months and months and months. They're still going to be making noises outside the library during the revision period.
Well, this is a bit off the topic of my book, but I'm very, very sympathetic, and I remember when you said something to me, Tony, about the fact that the new student atrium was going to lead on to a building site for a while, and what an unfortunate thing that was. You know what they say, the sun never sets, or the concrete never sets on the London School of Economics. I hope that this comes to an end at some point fairly soon. I mean, this it seems to me that when you arrive at the London School of Economics, it's a little hard to know what you've arrived at or where you are at. And so for that reason, years ago, I put forward a little piece that suggested that there are two ways we could make more of a unity about the buildings that we have. One has to do with bridges, and that's been developing, and the other has to do with the surface that we walk on. And for some, of course, when you deal with the surfaces, you're dealing with Westminster Council and all sorts of other interests, and it hasn't gone as smoothly as we like, but I beg of you, keep the faith that it will settle down.
You don't want to hear the sour of Westminster Council. It's been driving us all mad, I can tell you, over a period of some 9 months or something.
There's a question in the back.
I would like to hear your explication of if there is any, or whether there is any difference between interdisciplinarity and being aware of other disciplines. In other words, what is the relationship of methodology to your five or handful of social science disciplines?
I think that this is a very interesting point. Recently in News and Views, I was taken to task, not to put it, at its most polite, for being a bit of a dinosaur in these regards, and I guess that that's the case. In my book, I do talk quite a bit about interdisciplinary social science. It is the case, and I think this is an important distinction, that if one wants to do public policy, for example, if we want to define, you mentioned legalizing pot, I guess I haven't changed all those years, though I now feel that everything should be legalized. I guess that's a bit of a difference. But if one really seriously wants to address an issue like drugs policy, which I think is a very important, should be addressed, one would have to draw on lots of social science, and also lots beyond social science, probably a lot of medical information, a lot of psychological information, but indeed a lot of economics comes into it, and a lot of sociology, and to do policy, one has to draw on all of these subjects. But one of the things that I was interested in covering this vast amount of literature was to try to find cases where a researcher came up with the wrong answer by staying within a discipline. And I think there may be one or two, but it's very, very hard to find. There's a sharp distinction between undertaking research and designing policy. I mean, part of science is that you carve up areas and you deal with, as I was saying earlier on, tiny little slices of the whole. Now, of course, the truth may be totally integrated. Maybe to have complete truth, maybe everything in the universe affects everything else. I don't know. Maybe it does. I find fields very hard to understand, and maybe everything is connected to everything else, and to get ultimate truth, we would have to have a kind of comprehensive view. But even not going that far, maybe to have a really thorough understanding of any social phenomena, one would have to draw on all the social sciences. But science is not about getting comprehensive views. It's about getting understanding in making slices and little pieces. The only example, it seemed to me, that was jumping out from my investigation was a contrast between, say, sociology and economics in analysis of the causes of crime. The sociologists have things like ethnic composition, urbanization, income inequality, and so on, all those sorts of factors, but nothing about the state of law or deterrence or the amount of police on the street or anything like that. Whereas the economics literature is full of the probability of getting arrested, getting caught, and the penalties when you get caught and things like that. So we do get a bit of a difference there. But nevertheless, I think that there's a kind of fashion for interdisciplinary work, which is a little worrisome to me for a number of reasons. One is, I think the disciplines are just terribly important, and our goal at the London School of Economics, our work is I think, vital for humanity in the wider realm. It's vital for as an input into policy. But at the London School of Economics, we are not making policy as such. We are advancing knowledge. And advancing knowledge means division of labor, dividing up the field and trying to make progress on bits and pieces. Integrating knowledge and application is also a part of our activity, but I think it's a mistake to overemphasize interdisciplinary work. I hope that that's an answer to your question.
You make a strong argument for the similarity between natural science and social science. And you say that the difference between natural and social science is mostly one of emphasis and balance. But almost in passing, you mentioned that natural science tends to examine patterns and phenomena that are universal, that have an existence that is not contingent, whereas the social sciences tend not to. I think a natural scientist would have something to say about that and would say that the difference was pretty fundamental to what the science was all about. I wonder whether you see the social sciences moving in the future towards a study of more universal phenomena than they are at the moment.
Just to be a little personal for the moment, a distinguished economic theorist criticized a piece over dinner that I wrote about machine tools and said that, well, maybe what I said was right at that point in time, but who knows whether it's right today. And he said that he, as a theorist, does something else. He's working out eternal truths. He's doing something which he called making bricks. He's making these bricks, and eventually we'll have enough bricks, and then social science will be real science like the natural sciences. And I think, I must confess, we're still friends today in spite of that discussion, that I think that this is unlikely. I think that social science has to take account of the contingent nature of what we study. It is not always the case. It may be plastic money changes what economists have learned about monetary economics, or maybe it makes no difference at all. I just don't know. But what you have to do, it seems to me, in social science is continually renew explorations because of the fact that things might have changed. And in natural science, I suppose we can find examples too. I have heard physicists argue that the universe is aging and that that has some, that changes things. And certainly in biology, I think you would agree with me that there may be prions coming along or things that weren't there before or things change. But the important point is interconnected theories, observations, and so on. What is important in social science is that you have to continually renew the knowledge, and you can't rely on carrying something over. If you want to regard that as an absolutely fundamental difference, well, we could argue about what we mean by fundamental or whatever. It certainly is a difference of degree, and it does change somewhat the strategic stance of researchers in social science compared to natural science. Beyond that, would you come back at me on that point?
Strong objection to what you said, but I would just wonder if, given that difference of balance, whether the social sciences might not try a little bit harder to find a few more universals to prop up their contingent work.
Hi, my name is Hossein Janshah, University of London. I have a keen interest in European policymaking. And on a practical note, you've mentioned a few times that the role of the LSE in particular and of social scientists is to advance knowledge and to leave policymaking to the policymakers. Would it be fair to say that this book is an attempt at just picking off the continuation of knowledge and it could be read for European policymakers, or to come back to the point with regard to social scientists not being universal, could, for instance, if I was to read, could it be applied to European policy?
I make there's a lot of emphasis in the book on the wider use, particularly of the non-economic social sciences in public policy. The reason why I say that is economics is quite well established in public policy. I mean, the Monetary Commission nowadays has economists on it, not classic scholars and so on, and I think that that's well established, though there are things that worry me. For example, recently a study was commissioned of the economic consequences of having the Olympics in London, and an engineering firm, a possible builder of stadiums as a matter of fact, was asked to undertake that study. Now, I think that's pretty outrageous. I think economists should be at least involved in a study of the economic consequences of having the Olympics in London. But I nevertheless feel that economics in public policy is quite well established. But there are huge roles for anthropology, for example, as expert witnesses in cases that involve issues of culture and so on. There's huge room for a much wider use of social psychology in public policy and so on. Now, when you get to which is, I think, part of your question, of whether we should simply do our work and try to advance knowledge, well, I think that that's our major task and we certainly will do that. However, most or many of the people employed at the London School of Economics have active lives in public policy as well. And I think that that's a very good thing, and I think it's a way of easing the transmission of knowledge. However, I also think it gets a bit dangerous when people are regarded as having had an enormous achievement because they've appeared on television or things of that kind, and there have been cases where the school, I think, has leaned, and not only this institution, but lots of institutions, of favoring people because they were involved in public policy. If you come up with a really important new idea, as say Amartya Sen did when he was working at the London School of Economics on famine. Now, famine is a great social problem, and coming up with an important new idea on that subject is a very, very important thing. And there's no question that that has been carried over to policy. The idea that we will come up with great ideas, but the public policy community will not use them, I think I'm less worried about that. The important thing is for us to come up with the ideas. That's what I...
This probably should be the last question, so please make it a particularly testing one.
I'll try. Max, I'd like to challenge the idea that there are firm disciplinary boundaries, especially as you mentioned the idea of staying within your discipline. To give you an example, I don't see any clear boundary between economic theory and theoretical evolutionary biology. there are many problems that really have exactly the same form, and when you write your paper, you have to say, do I address this at the economist or at the biologist, or write in this style or in that style? And in fact, the what you're doing, building, is fundamentally the same. The thought processes, the structures, everything's the same. So when you talk about staying within a discipline, would you like to sort out this problem of disciplines that merge into each other?
It certainly is the case that there are, from time to time, formal analogies. And it could well be that the evolutionarily stable equilibrium in evolutionary theory is very analogous to the equilibrium of pizza versus hamburger joints in a city. So that if everybody's making pizza joints, then the payoff to doing hamburgers goes up, and if everybody's doing hamburgers, then the payoff to pizzas go up. And what we would expect applying the mathematical model is a kind of evolutionary equilibrium, which may be exactly like what Maynard Smith had in mind. Formally speaking, there are these formal similarities, and they've gone through natural and social science. For example, Brownian motion is a concept which has moved back and forth between physics and economics, and there are lots of examples of formal similarities. I think the more you know, the better, and if you can find analogies that are helpful, I think that's great. However, I do feel that science advances through establishments, clubs. They exist in universities, in journals, in professional societies, and it's important that they not be airtight. Every now and then, people outside the establishment, Karl Marx is an example, Madame Curie was an example, do work that nevertheless turns out to be leading an important work, and they eventually get absorbed into the establishment. And I certainly don't want the establishments to have monopolies. But without establishments, it's very hard to address the type of issues that Tony was talking about, going to the government for funding and so on. You need some sense of hierarchy, of authority, and so on. Now, as a scholar, making your own strategy in this difficult maze, nothing within the research that I've undertaken in my book, I think, constrains anybody. What it does suggest is that the quality of ideas and understanding and empirical investigation that goes on within the disciplines is of a very high order, and there's a great deal of it. And I think that that will continue. And as I said in my concluding remarks, whatever else happens, I certainly hope that the London School of Economics does make the running in the disciplines and make the contribution that it's capable of. That's what I think.
Do you want to just ask this last question fairly quickly? Because I think we've only got time for one, I'm afraid, really.
The Rees lectures on globalization of a couple of years ago, if you could each answer this question, were they social poetry or social science? Yes, no, or pass. I just would like to know the answer.
I never mention names, you may notice. Why don't we take your question?
Yes, just take the
microphone. Would you want to just take the microphone? My name is Liv Mogensen. I study IR here at the London School of Economics. And what you said about other social science disciplines not having theories, I think that international relations do make theories that make suggestions about what might happen in the future. But I do also think that by only focusing on some kind of rational choice approach like economics does, and not focusing on some approaches that might not be rational, but more focus on Verstehen instead of rational choice, if you don't focus on these things that you would not call social science, you cannot focus on things like identity as factors. And if you don't focus on identity, it might be hard to explain conflicts that are religious or Middle East, whatever. And if you don't consider that to be social science, then you have a problem of announcing some problems that are really important, I think.
I'm so glad you asked that, and I'm a little surprised that you could have deduced from what I said that I don't regard issues like identity and so on as part of social science. Absolutely. And I certainly do feel that there are theories involved in political science and in sociology and social psychology, which are different from economics and perfectly valid. The point that I made was really a little different, and let me just repeat it now. I'm saying that if you turn to the literature, the research that people actually undertake of the past decade in the topics that I've explored, and I think it wouldn't be any different, this is an assertion, if you chose six different topics, you will not find a single case of pure theory investigation. That doesn't mean that there's not articles which involve theories. For example, I talked about that paper in political science on the Maastricht Treaty, which definitely involved political science theories. But there's no pure theory exercise. There's no attempt to try to set out a framework and derive answers on the basis of some theoretical structure. Now, I believe that that particular aspect, that particular leg of science, which is not the whole story, it only is a part, further development of pure theory investigation. Now, we do have some in international relations, for example. There's voting theory, which is a pure theory exercise, just like utility theory or any other parts. And one of the reasons why I think it's terribly important for theoretical development in the non-economic social sciences is precisely for what you say, because it will be different theories. I think people are imprinted. I think people that role theory, for example, in sociology, is a very important, valid, and interesting area to explore, and it will benefit from a more careful, pure theory investigation rather than the kind of rather intuitive theory that one often comes across. So please read my book.
Well, I think you should say buy my book, actually. And for those of you who enjoyed that event, look at your events leaflet this week. There's an amazing variety of other events on at the LSE to sample during the course of the week, some scientific and some, I think by Max's criteria, pretty unscientific but interesting nevertheless. Can I remind everyone, if you don't know, there is a reception following now immediately. Is it in the senior dining room?
Yes.
In the senior dining room on the fifth floor of the old building. Don't all go at once because the lifts are too small to accommodate everybody, but everyone is invited. In the meantime, please let everyone thank Max for his lecture and for the interesting debate which it provoked. Thanks very much, Max.